From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. We're your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening on the program, we're speaking with award-winning journalist, author, and UBC creative writing professor, Deborah Campbell. Her new book, A Disappearance in Damascus, A Story of Friendship and Survival in the Shadow of War, was recently nominated for the Hillary Weston Writers' Trust Nonfiction Award. It's the story of her search for her Iraqi fixer, who was arrested while Deborah was in Syria reporting on the refugee experience.
I'm Deborah Campbell. I teach in the creative writing program at UBC, and I occasionally teach in the journalism school as well.
Can you tell us where we are?
We are right outside the Ideas Lounge at the Wall Institute, one of my favorite places on campus, little known, and it's sort of hidden inside the Wall Institute, so you have to go around four or five bends, and that's perhaps why it's a little oasis in the middle of campus.
Your book, A Disappearance in Damascus, is just recently released, and it's about, a year of trips you took to Syria. What were you doing there?
Well, originally I went in order to write a piece for Harper's Magazine. I was doing a piece on, it was in 2007, and I was there until mid-2008, and I was researching the exodus of 1.5 million Iraqis out of Iraq into Syria when they were fleeing the war. And I went there because I felt as if a lot of journalists were embedding with military, and very few were bedding with civilians. So I wanted to do that, and it was impossible by that time in Iraq because journalists were being killed, they were being kidnapped, and Syria was still a peaceful, tolerant place, very different from what we see today. And it was a place where I could go and spend limitless amounts of time with Iraqi civilians and essentially hear the stories of why they had fled.
And your book itself is about someone special you met there, Ahlam?
That's right. So the book I've written is not the story that I went there to tell. It's when you're doing foreign correspondence, in order to get access to information, sources, often journalists will employ fixers. These are our guides, interpreters, people who make arrangements, open doors for you. And especially as I was trying to get close to people who had been through such trauma, people who wouldn't necessarily trust outsiders, I needed a fixer to open doors for me. And I met Ahlam, a very interesting Iraqi woman who had been a fixer in Baghdad as well, who had run a humanitarian center in Baghdad before being kidnapped for ransom. And after she was ransomed, had come to Damascus. And she was essentially the key fixer for a lot of the global journalists, BBC, Al Jazeera, other groups like that. And she was a really warm, adventurous, interesting, intelligent person who had seen more sides of the war than anyone I'd ever met, having seen both the civilian and military side, male and female, all kinds of situations. So she knew it very well, and she also knew people. She inspired trust among the people I wanted to talk to and opened those doors for me, and we became really good friends.
What was it about her that made people trust her?
At the time, it was really a situation where society had broken apart in Iraq. It was the height of the civil war. There were 1,000 bodies a month showing up on the streets of Baghdad. When people arrived in Syria, they were shattered. They were disoriented. Mostly it was the middle and professional classes that had left the country, the people that had kept Iraq running. And Ahlam had a past of being a community organizer. She was the daughter of a sheikh from a small village on the outskirts of Baghdad, and she had been the first girl in her village to go to high school ever, and the first male or female from her village to graduate from university. So she was educated, but she also really understood community relationships and leadership, having also run a humanitarian center in Baghdad. So when she arrived in Damascus, she saw that nobody was in charge and essentially that work needed doing. And her father had always said to her, wherever you are, begin. begin and the rest will follow. And that was her ethos. She believed, well, start it yourself. So she started a small school for Iraqi displaced teenage girls out of her apartment. And she was also essentially a one-woman NGO. She was organizing aid, getting volunteer contributions to supply basic needs, and also liaising with the UN Refugee Agency as a volunteer representative in her neighborhood. And she became like the mayor of the largest concentration of Iraqis outside of Iraq at that time.
You became quite close to her, and as a fixer, this was unique. What ended up happening?
Well, I knew from very early on in my friendship with her and my working relationship with her that she was being watched. She had seen a man standing outside her apartment building taking photographs of her when she came and went. She'd been followed when she went to buy groceries. She would see, you know, a camera flash going off. And she figured actually that it was her Iraqi kidnappers that had followed her across the border to try again, because it was quite common in the mass kidnapping that was going on in the country to, if someone paid a ransom, kidnap them again and go for it again. So she figured that was going on. It took a while for her to understand that that was not who was following her. The people who were following her were the Syrian secret police. And so this continued for a long time, and they had pressured her to spy on journalists, pressured her to spy on human rights workers and also other refugees, which she refused to do. And so about 9 months after we met, I was at her apartment one day. I would go over there in the mornings, get the news, hear what was going on in the neighborhood. She knew everyone. She knew what was going on and had so many connections. There was a knock at the door. And there was a man came in shortly after and told her she was to go with them and said to her about me, get rid of her. And so Ahlam told me that I had to go immediately. And I picked up my bag and I left. And she'd been told that she'd just be going to speak to them for questioning a couple of hours. It wasn't the first time she'd been questioned. Maybe it had happened a dozen times before. But this time I just felt something very different about it. I mean, not only was I there and I witnessed it, but she had never been picked up by a group of men like this. And there was a different feeling in the air. And I had felt that day when I'd gone to her place, just that little frisson at the back of your neck where you feel like you're being watched. I felt that. And I had ignored it because I thought, oh, it's just, you know, locals in the neighborhood wondering who the Westerner is, because there were no Westerners in this neighborhood whatsoever. So at this point, I knew that things were really bad. And so from then on, I was in a position where she's gone. Where's she gone? Why has she been taken? Was she taken because of me? I was working undercover. Maybe I've put her in jeopardy. I don't know. I don't know the situation. Nor can I contact people to get information about her, because anyone I phone, there's a phone record. Anyone I talk to, if she's in danger, then I'm in danger. I can put anyone in danger. So it was a terrible catch-22 situation where I had to do something, but I couldn't do anything.
Throughout the book, and definitely at the beginning, you admit to feeling hopelessness as a writer, or just kind of questioning what you were doing there and what your storytelling could do and how it would affect. You said at one point, like a medieval doctor bleeding patients with some promise of healing. And I wondered, with space, how you think about your this book and how your stories, how they fit in, how they work now.
Well, I think that most journalists, when they start out with a lot of hope for righting wrongs, for creating change in the world. And as you progress in your career, you put out these pieces, and sometimes they actually get a lot of attention. Sometimes people are really talking about them. And at the same time, you look at the world after your pieces come out, and it's exactly the same. So maybe more people are aware of things, but nothing really changes. And when you're talking about a juggernaut like war, a juggernaut like the invasion of Iraq, which destabilized the entire region, including Syria. Really, you cannot see the Syrian war outside of the Iraq war. And already it was clear that the consequences would be going on for years, if not generations. I would say generations. And in people's lives, I was having people tell me these stories of such devastation, the kind of story that if it happened to one family here would be a front page news story for a long period of time. But over there was just so normal that when people would tell me their stories, they would say, why are you interested in this? This happened to everyone. It was so normal to have your life completely destroyed, to see friends and family murdered, kidnapped. You know, these are people who had very lives not so different from how we live here, you know, employed, educated, middle class people who will never get over these scars. And so when I was listening to these stories, I began to feel a sense of despair, like, I know, I've been at this long enough to know that it doesn't matter what I write, it's not going to change it. And I was going through that at the time, just feeling a sense of the inability of writing to really create the kind of change I wanted. And in some ways, that was what really impressed me about Ahlam, was that she wasn't writing, she was doing things. She was starting a school, she was making sure people got food. She was helping people in concrete ways and providing leadership and community and humor and life. And in a way, it felt more real to me than bearing witness. And so I think when I think about my book now, it's something that someone said to me when I was beginning work on this. He said, I explained my ongoing, lingering existential crisis about the meaning of what we do as journalists and writers. And he said, Deborah, you know, the point isn't to change the world. He said, it's to keep the truth alive. And I've thought about that a lot. I think it matters that what happened be recorded, especially as it's been largely overlooked. It's the main story, but it's the untold story. And so I feel that I've put something on record that deserves to be there, and I've done it through focusing on the story of what happened to my fixer and friend. And she stands in for a million people, millions of people, whose voices will never be heard.
Speaking of record, your book is so full of rich detail. How much note-taking did you do? Because, of course, you didn't go over there thinking you were going to write a book, and yet you transport us into scenes so vividly.
Well, I always take a lot of field notes, not knowing what I'm going to do with them. I'm experienced in the sense of knowing that you don't know what you're going to need. So capture everything. And so I'm always taking notes of how things look, how they smell, little moments, small moments that often will illuminate something larger down the line. So probably I had 1,000 pages of notebook notes. I had many hundreds of pages of transcripts. With that, I would go through, and essentially 90% of what I have in my notebooks is not in the book. It was a matter of choosing the details that were the telling details, the details that would bring the story to life, but not overwhelming the reader with the whole of my field notes, which anyway are so illegible that they wouldn't want to read them.
Did you worry at any point about keeping such detailed notes, especially as Ahlam was imprisoned and you yourself felt in danger?
Absolutely. And again, I have worked in countries like, Israel, Palestine, or Iran, places where I am concerned about what will happen to the people I write about afterwards. So I have a habit of keeping names apart from notes. So I will keep them in a separate part of my notebook. And then when she was taken, I immediately went through my notes and tore up names, phone numbers. I erased text messages, and I knew that, you know, most people didn't email me there, they all texted, so I got that off my phone, and I made sure that there wasn't anything identifiable in my notes should they be taken. Illegible, as they do tend to be.
Going back a bit, but in journalism, the term fixer, what are ethical concerns or questions around fixers today, or that you think about when you're engaging with someone?
Well, generally, I would not work with someone who is an official fixer. If they are, it means that they have cultivated often relationships with authorities, so they are known. And then I can't be sure that they're not going to report back about what I do. I look for people who I can work with on a casual basis, whom I really trust and who are off the radar themselves. So they could be anyone. I could run into a really smart university student who's gifted and game for whatever I have in mind, or someone, often it's local journalists actually, who are, they have a lot of contacts, they really understand this scenario. What I want to know is someone who knows people, they know what's going on, they know the security situation, they know the culture. They can perhaps work as interpreters for me, but they can also give me good advice on how to behave in a situation and also when to get out of there. So that's what I look for, and I have to like them, because if I don't like them, it means I probably don't trust them. I have to really trust them. I have to trust that they're interpreting properly, that they actually know the situation, that they don't have political or religious or ethnic allegiances that are going to make them want to blind me to other sides of the story. And also, I'll use a different person in a different place. So different communities. See, being an outsider can be a real advantage in divided communities, where, say, the ordinary person couldn't jump between gender, between class, between religious or national divides. But being an outsider, I can. But it means that I might bring someone different into a different situation, because that person would know how to behave, or know how, or would be accepted by that group and not distrusted. So the fact that the community trusts them and that I trust them is essentially the key to a good fixer.
How does this kind of book and your writing in general fit into the larger ecology of journalism?
Often people don't think of journalism as literature. They're used to journalism as sort of page A1, you know, what happened yesterday, that sort of thing. And the kind of work that I'm doing is a little different in the sense that I write, and some people have said it's more novelistically because they're more used to the A section of the newspaper, but it's storytelling essentially. So, and my interest has been largely in the lives of people who live through political or geopolitical events. And I think that by storytelling and talking about their lives and bringing them to life, it looks a little bit different than what we think of when we think of daily news or what we get off Google News in the morning.
And why do we need both kinds?
Well, I think it's really important to know what happened yesterday and to follow a story over time. And even if you're getting, say, a 2-minute update on what's happening, that's really important. And it's important to know what the powers that be are saying. It's important to know what our politicians, our military leaders are up to, and what they say they're up to. But it's also really important to know how those decisions actually play out in people's lives. And so that, for me, has always been more interesting, more complex in some ways, because you can't just automatically gain interest. I mean, if a politician says something, if Justin Trudeau says something, we listen. Why? Because he's Justin Trudeau. That's it. So in order to have them listen to what my fixer Ahlam has to say, I have to essentially show you who she is first and tell you about her life, and then the reader gets invested.
Just to put everyone's mind at ease, how is Ahlam and her family today?
They are doing very well. And yes, it does end up being a good ending to a very, very challenging time. And her kids are great. And actually, her daughter just started university last month, and she's doing really well.
You're a creative writing teacher here at UBC, and you have been for 10 years. Is there one piece of advice you'd give to creative writing students, or just writing students in general?
I think if you are going to do it, you go all in, and be aware that it takes time to establish yourself. I see some new grads and they're upset because it's been a year and they still aren't a staff writer at the New Yorker, and give it 10. If you're going to do this, it's because the work has chosen you.
How does teaching writing on a university campus affect your own writing process?
Well, I love the freedom that I see in my students' writing. Sometimes they don't know how it should be done, and therefore they do it better. And I also feel like there's a real generational exchange where I'm learning about the ideas that interest them, and they're getting my take on those things. So I feel like there's a mutual education going on in the classes that I teach. And I really try to teach classes that are rather like literary salons, where we discuss big ideas and not just the minutiae of structure or language, but go even farther than that.
You were just nominated for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Nonfiction Award. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What does it mean to you as a writer to receive these kinds of accolades?
Well, first of all, it's a validation. It's a great honor to be in that company. But I think really what it means is the possibility of a wider audience for a book. Right now, the world is flooded with words every day. People probably spend more time with words than they ever have in history. And so they get a lot of choice. And I think there are a lot fewer people that are reading books. And so it's really validating to be put in that company and have the book get a chance in the world.
Deborah, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're most welcome.
That was Deborah Campbell, UBC creative writing professor and author of A Disappearance in Damascus, A Story of Friendship and Survival in the Shadow of War. She'll be making a few appearances at the Vancouver Writers Fest, which runs from October 17th to 23rd, and she'll be at Green College here on campus for a reading on November 5th.
Students in the Faculty of Arts have the chance to explore career options in the Arts Co-op and Arts Internship programs. We met up with a couple of students last week who had co-op placements last year.
Okay, my name is Ralph. I major in International Relations. I'm in the Arts Co-op program, and so my first co-op placement was with Lower Balance Media Group, and my second one was at the U.S. Consulate. It was very fun. The view is amazing. The view is absolutely stunning. It was a little bit intimidating because they have to sort of frisk you a little bit. They have to check like the sort of stuff you have. It's basically going into the airport. Like, you take your shoes off, it's secure. I had to walk through 5 doors, and different codes and swiping different cards just to get into my office.
So my name's Morelle Andrews. I am an international relations major, and I did both of my 2 co-op terms at Global Affairs Canada in Ottawa. So I was responsible alone for our bilateral commercial relations with Germany, Austria, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Hungary. Oh my gosh, it was so much responsibility. I was shocked because I think of myself as an undergrad that's not exactly as legit as the other people who worked in my division, but it was a lot to take on, and it was at times overwhelming, but it was such an amazing learning experience, actually having that amount of responsibility given to me.
Biggest learning moment: the U.S. ambassador to Canada came for a trip, just a weekend, three, four days, I think, Bruce A. Heyman, and I was the public affairs intern, and so I had to follow him, take photos, tweet, Facebook, Instagram, like the whole shebang. And so I was with him throughout basically the 2 days in the car. And so the first day I wanted to impress for some reason, because I was a young student, I guess. I wanted to make it seem like, I was like on my game and stuff. And that sort of, it didn't seem natural to me. And so the second day, it felt like I should just do my own thing, focus on what I'm good at, and then you'll take it from there. And it was better the second day when I just focused on what I wanted to do and not so much be impressing other people. So
So this was right after Brexit happened. So it was like June 24th, and everyone was scrambling because, one, we didn't think Brexit was going to happen, and two, our minister actually had already planned to go visit the UK. So her briefing book had been written, and all of a sudden, her chief of staff and her aides on the policy side came down and said, okay, like, we actually want an entire economic write-up of what our previous relationship was in terms of trade back and forth with the European Union. How has it changed? And then we also want that for the UK. And they just gave this job to me, and I had to scramble around for the whole day, like, doing calculations on trade that is not my area of specialty at all. Like, I'm horrible at math. But just, it was so stressful. It was the most stressful thing maybe that I've ever done, knowing how much was on the line. Yeah.
So, like, how did you feel about yourself at the end of that day?
Man, I felt really proud. I was, because for me, when I found myself in situations where I had to, like, hammer out a briefing product or get in a recommendation or three recommendations in 2 hours, that's when I really enjoyed myself the most, because those are the conditions that I work the best under. So going forward, I know now in my career that I really want something that's high demand and high pressure, because that's just my natural state of work. Yeah, I like putting out the fires.
What's the biggest piece of advice you would give to a student doing a co-op this year?
It's never as glamorous as you think it is, okay? That's the first thing. You have to realize that. But once you realize that and you take on more responsibility and you understand what you're doing, you have the ability to shine. And I'm not talking about, oh my God, Ralph, you're doing well. I'm talking about, like, whoa, like, your work actually contributed to XYZ. So it's not as glamorous as you think it is, but once you realize that and you sort of move on, and then you can progress and transcend the sort of intern role. As again, I said, they're all very warm, they're all very caring, and they understand, you know, you're learning, you're a 20-year-old kid, you don't know much, and that's the point of having interns, right? So to help them and to help you too. So
if you're just looking to go do a term, do what's required of you and then leave, you're not going to get as much out of it. So my advice would be aggressive and really challenge yourself to go to the next level, because you're going to get a lot out of it if you do.
You can find out more about the Arts Co-op and internship programs on the Faculty of Arts website.
You've been listening to UBC Arts on Air on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We are your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. Join us for our next episode, when we'll be speaking with UBC psychology professor Jessica Tracy about her new book, Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. That episode airs at 6:30 on Monday, October 17th. And if you can't wait until then, you can hear Professor Tracy read an excerpt of her book at a launch here on campus on October 13th at 4 o'clock. That's in the Lillooet Room of the Irving K. Barber Learning Center.
That's all for this week. Thanks for listening.